Welcome to this episode of Stories of Our Ancestors, in which students of the U.S. Naval Academy share remarkable accounts of their ancestors, triumphs and tragedies, and how they fit into the remarkable mosaic of American history and society. With us in the studio today are Captain Bob Q, Lieutenant Terrence Viernis, and myself, Associate Professor Thomas Burgess. As instructors in the Department of History, all three of us have come to know many midshipmen in Annapolis, but never had the chance until now to hear about their amazing ancestors.
This episode showcases the theme of diversity, in that we will hear three very unique stories about a professional rhythm and blues singer, a Native American tribal elder, and an African American farmer and community leader. They remind us that life experiences can be very different from one another, yet at the same time, all uniquely American stories.
In our first story today, Midshipman Kayla Gillams recounts the inspiring trajectory of the life of her grandfather, Jordan Arline. From his humble beginnings in the late 19th century Jim Crow South to an esteemed champion of justice in his community, Gillams traces a life whose impact correlates beautifully with a nationwide struggle for racial justice.
People get ready, there's a train a coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the dealers humming. Don't need no ticket, you just thank the Lord.
My name is Kayla Gillams, and I will be speaking about the patriarch of my family and how he lived through the civil rights movement. My grandpa, Jordan Arline, more affectionately known as Grandpa Jordan, was born in the Jim Crow era on February 2, 1891, in a small county in southwest Georgia. His father, Henry, was a handsome, light-skinned man who grew up living with a mulatto man, Mr. Grimsley, who took him in at a young age. Mr. Grimsley had given Henry 50 acres of land for the time he labored in his fields as a sharecropper while living in his home. His mother, Patience, was the child of Mr. Spooner, a white slave owner, and her mother, Hagar. Henry frequented the Spooner plantation to court Patience, and they soon began a family on the land he received from Mr. Grimsley. Henry and Patience lived together with her sick father and their three children in a small home he built on that land. My grandpa Jordan was the fourth born child. Growing up, he was a very bold man for his time, not perceiving his skin tone as a barrier to be a full-fledged member of society in Miller County. When his father passed, Jordan took ownership of the Arline acreage, and through years of selling his produce, he grew the land to 200 acres. He lived in that same family home with his wife, Hester, and they began a family of their own. Many of his siblings migrated to the North in frustration with the prejudiced, antiquated laws of the South. Grandpa Jordan stayed to support his family and did not run away when faced with threats of violence from the local KKK members. In the 50s, he took up the passion of fighting for the right to vote. In Miller County, he was one of the first Black men to publicly vote, even when it was not legally his right to do so. He traveled to Atlanta to participate in protests in the state capitol, and when he returned, he was faced with vitriol from those who thought he was becoming too big for his status as a Negro in America. One night, members of the Klan burned crosses in his yard, and while it shocked him, Jordan did not pack his bags and leave town. He was way too stubborn for that. Instead, he sent his wife and children to stay with their nearby relatives for the night, and told his son to give word to his brother about what happened. Jordan told his son, "Go tell Johnny to grab the shotguns," and they sat out on the porch all night waiting for the return of any more trespassers. That was the kind of man he was. That was not the only incident he had to stand up to white aggression. There were a few other times when he had to face the mob for the protection of his family, but since he was a respected provider for many people in the county, he was not tried often. What is notable about my grandfather is he was never a sharecropper. He owned 100% of his cattle and produce and gave to the community in times of desperation. This was extremely rare for a Black man in the American South during the 1950s, and his boldness established him as a fixture in the community. During the Great Depression, He did not feel his pockets hurt in the way many Americans across the country did. He was a generous man, always willing to give food to the black and white members of the county when starvation was running rampant. When his wife Hester passed, Grandpa remarried to my Grandma Ida, and I am a descendant of their son Milton. Ida was a young woman going to school to become a school teacher. This happened to align with Jordan's values of education well, and together they opened the first school in Thomasville, Georgia. Though he had no formal education, Jordan's mother taught him how to read and write from a young age. Education has always been a priority for my family, and even when there were not a lot of opportunities for young black kids to be in the classroom, they found a way to make it accessible. To continue his streak of civil rights activism in education, Jordan volunteered his high school age son, Joe, to be the first black student in the trial run of integration at the all-white school in the county. For 1 year, Joe went to school with the protection of the FBI, and though it was a turbulent time, Jordan did not falter in his decision for his family to be a part of the change. Jordan Arline passed away on April 2nd, 1968. His absence was felt greatly in Miller County, and it has never been the same since he left this world. What is uncanny about the timing of his death is that it was the same year Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy were assassinated. It seemed like the civil rights movement was taking losses left and right on the national and local levels. His legacy of generosity, education, and entrepreneurship have been carried forward by generations of Arlines. My grandfather now lives on that land and in that home, and its walls hold the memories of the people who survived through their struggles in order for me to be where I am today. That is the story of the life of Jordan Arline and the roots he left behind.
Don't need no ticket. You just thank the Lord.
You know, I think this story really reminds me of one of the incredible parts of this project and one of the real benefits, which is that it forces us to think about history as more than just abstract ideas, you know, black and white pictures in the book, you know, some dry text describing an event. You know, once you start talking to the people who come before you, you quickly realize that, one, this happened not very long ago, and two, it makes the events just so much more vivid and real. These are people who lived through these events. I think the story is just a great example of that, right? Events like the Civil Rights Movement, even going all the way back to sharecropping. You start talking to people who came before you, you very quickly realize the reality and just the extra punch of those events, knowing that people you know, you love, you grew up with, lived through them.
I was one of those people that had to read about these experiences. I didn't encounter them firsthand in my life. And one first encounter I had was reading the book Black Like Me about a Texas white journalist who actually artificially darkens his skin in the 1950s and then travels to the South posing as a black man and writing about his experience as such. And it was just shocking to read of his experiences doing so and the kind of racism that he encountered right and left, which I think does speak to the fact that things have improved a lot since those days.
Yeah, and what I think is especially beautiful here is that even if we strip away the theme of civil rights struggle, if we strip away black and white, race relations, there's still the strong sense of justice in Jordan Arline's life, right? He's a giving man. You know, when he sees that there's KKK intimidation in his community, he meets it with armed resistance. He's bold in the face of that intimidation. When he sees that his community is struggling during the Great Depression, he helps feed the community. And finally, when there's a lack of education, he goes ahead and builds a school, right? And man, that's a very human way to react and respond to these very historical struggles.
Yeah, you can see why he's inspirational to those who came after him and his family.
Yeah, you know, continuing on this theme of being an inspiration, that's a great segue, actually, into our second recording. In this recording, Midshipman Hernandez talks about interviewing her great-great-aunt, who is the, quote, eldest elder of her Native American tribe in California. While they're able to bond over the shared experience of growing up indigenous in America, at the same time, Midshipman Hernandez also learns a lot of valuable lessons about the meaning of culture, assimilation, and survival. Let's listen.
Overnight, overnight, here we are. Josephine, a.k.a. Sister Romero, is a 90-year-old Native American on the Boronea Indian Reservation in San Diego, California. The Kumeyaay tribe is a small group of a few hundred Indians spread over three reservations here. Sister is my great-great-aunt and is considered our eldest elder on the reservation today. She's called this because even though she's not the oldest member still living, she still has all of her memory as a child, and thus is considered the most wise and senior member in our tribe. My name is Jenna Hernandez, a third class, class of 2025, at the Naval Academy, and I wanted to interview Sister for my ancestry project as to tackle an ongoing question within society of culture, customs, and traditions, ideas of whether or not groups should still acknowledge certain cultural aspects of their identity, or if it separates the positive ideas of globalization in the U.S. My aunt Sister seemed to be the best candidate to answer my questions, as she has seen the world change around her and guided me to alter my opinions on the word culture. After her son, the current chairman or chief of the tribe, finally helped her learn that she doesn't need to yell at the computer for me to hear her through Skype, we ended up talking for hours about her growing up Indian in a seemingly unchanging society, about why her experience growing up on the reservation was different than mine. To start, she told me stories about speaking the native language as a child, and stories of her and her siblings being assimilated into white culture in middle school, by being forced off the reservation and placed into an English-speaking school. While Native Assimilation Acts forced her off the reservation, it also pushed Indians to be closer than ever, and to subconsciously cause a hatred for life outside of the reservation borders. She also has told me stories about there being so few cars driven at the time that she could tell who was pulling up to her house just by the sound of the engine. While we grew up very differently, we also found similarities in our childhood. And while every day my father drove me to a school an hour away because he thought it would give me the best education, I also got the same questions that she did, such as, does your house have real walls? Or, did you wash off your face paint before you got to school? And even, you know, I'm 1/32nd Indian. Maybe we're related. I mean, come on. We shared laughs about how while the world is so much more accepting, ignorance is still very much alive. And maybe that will always be the case. To quote Aunt Sister, our culture is all we have of this identity, but that means it only has to be shared within ourselves. To say that culture is dying is to say that we are dying, and that we are not a living, heart-beating, innovating, and changing race. I went into this interview almost trying to convince Aunt Sister that Indian culture is on its last legs. But in front of me stood a woman with long silver gray hair at the root and a hint of lipstick on, and a ton of sass telling me that if she died tomorrow, the tribe would still thrive. And while her and I disagreed on the concept of culture, she opened my eyes to what the word culture actually meant. And while I now don't think culture of the Indian tribe will ever die, it's important to note that it's okay that the culture changes. Now, I'm not going to lie, the classic Native perspective interview is a staple for any humanities class that I take, because it's a perspective that's lacking so much within U.S. history that I know any of the 500 people within a 5-mile radius of my house can give their input on, and it will be something different from others. Something that makes this interview so powerful is that after I conducted this interview on December 1st, 2022, Aunt Sister was rushed to a hospital about 20 miles away from her house. While she's fine and she's going to be okay, it gave me a sense of anxiety that what if I was her last perspective, her last known interview on Native culture and life? Would I really be willing to share her video in this podcast with my family? After looking over the hours of content that I recorded of her, I was filled with clarity and calmness, knowing that she believes in the tribe, and that if anything were to happen, if she were to die tomorrow, that the tribe would be okay because culture would still thrive.
Yeah, one of the things I really appreciate about Midshipman Hernandez's approach is her questioning, her willingness to sort of acknowledge the diversity of opinion within her own tribal community about basic questions about assimilation, whether forced or voluntary, the question of culture, is culture static or is it changing? And if it does change, is it still sacred? These are kinds of questions that she's asking, and she recognizes that there are all kinds of different answers to these questions. So I appreciate that openness and sort of curiosity.
What I really enjoyed from her story is there's this idea of a persistence or a tenacity of culture. And despite the Native American, their tribe, the Kumeyaay tribe, becoming smaller or, her passing, she has a lot of faith and optimism that the tribe will thrive. And I think that was really neat. And you see this kind of common trope in a lot of immigrant cultures where they come into the United States and a lot of that old world identity gets fades into the background. But that faith and optimism, I mean, it reflects the idea that, the old world mentality, old cultures continue to survive despite operating in the broader American context.
Everyone really enjoyed her little joke about how, the Native American interview is a staple of every humanities class. I thought that was great. I thought it had a little bit of humor, a little bit of self-awareness, maybe even a little bit of skepticism. And I think that makes it all the more cool that she went in, she did the interview, and she felt like she actually learned a lot, right? She actually learned a lot about culture and what it means for culture to survive and transform. So I really enjoyed this interview.
In our last story, Midshipman Isles finally recalls his grandfather's days as a singer in a church choir, and later as a professional rhythm and blues singer who ultimately gave up a promising career in music for the sake of his family.
I'm Midshipman Third Class Isles, Class of 2025, from Stuart, Florida. Today, I'll be telling the story of my grandfather, Bill Isles. My father would take my brothers and I out to California to see him every summer. I've been told of my grandfather's greatness since I can remember, but it has not been since I've grown older and since his passing back in 2019 that I have appreciated, realized, or even grasped his greatness and his story. My purpose in this podcast is to spread his story and personally appreciate his time and role in my life, father's life, and my brother's too. My grandfather, Bill Isles, was born on the 4th of January, 1941 in Mechanicsville, North Carolina. His mother moved the family to Canton, Ohio when he was 2 years old after the passing of his father. Growing up as a churchgoer in Canton, Ohio, he met his childhood friends, Eddie LaVert, Walter Williams, William Powell, and Bobby Massey, where they sang in the choir together. In 1958, in high school, they formed a group called the Mascots, where they sang at school proms, talent shows, and events of that nature. In 1961, now out of school and under a new name, The Triumphs, they released their first single called Miracles. It was released on King Records, a Cincinnati label that was also working with the famous James Brown. One day, in their days after high school, after performing at a club, a local popular DJ, Eddie OJ, walked up and wanted to promote them. He eventually got them to change their name to the OJs. Eddie sent them out to Los Angeles, where they worked with a producer by the name of H.B. Barnum, who had or would end up working with Frank Sinatra, Jackson 5, The Temptations, and more. While with H.B. Barnum, they worked on their harmonies and choreography. The R&B group would soon go on to draw attention with their early hits, one of which was by the name of Lonely Drifter, in 1963, which hit number 93 on the U.S. Billboard Hot 100. Another one of their hits early on was Lipstick Traces in 1965, which hit number 19 in Canada, and which they performed on the ABC TV program Chivalry, which is now known as hosting Stevie Wonder, James Brown, and Marvin Gaye. A short time later, after meeting his wife, Laurel, my grandfather decided to split from the group and focus on his family. The OJs continued on, and in the 1970s, my grandfather tried rejoining the group, but with the record label already being printed with three figures on the front, he could only continue as a manager. While as a manager, the OJs reached their prime with their most prominent hits, For the Love of the Money, Backstabbers, and their most popular song, Love Train, which reached number one on the Hot 100 Billboard. The song's message was a major contributor to its success as it called for everyone to join hands and hop on the love train, promoting world peace and unity at a time where tensions were high with communism, the Vietnam War, and the Cold War. The song mentions China, Russia, Egypt, Israel, and Africa. Love Train can still be heard on many platforms, including movies, and was even played on TV leading up to the ball drop on New Year's Eve in 2004. In 2005, the OGs were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame by Justin Timberlake. Sadly, my grandfather was not included due to his absence while they were at their peak. But I and many others still see him as a Hall of Famer and a family man. I appreciate my grandfather Bill Iles for his greatness and his passion for music. He continued to sing his entire life, even after the OGs, mostly for the church. Also, for sticking to his values by leaving the group for the well-being of his family, despite his clear passion for his career. I have just recently focused more attention to his musical life. Most of my memories of him are fishing, camping, watching movies, and barbecuing at the beach and backyard. The coolest part of Bill Iles is seeing his passion of singing trickle down through the family to my father and his brothers, which ended up forming a group of their own too. I've told the story of my grandfather as a way of remembrance since his passing in March of 2019.
Ask me how I know, and I'll tell you so. You used to be my girl. I respect her.
Well, this story really struck a personal chord because I was a huge OJ's fan as a boy growing up, and I bought their 45, their single, She Used to Be My Girl, and it just was so catchy, heard on the radio, and had to rush out and buy my own single. But I think also the story really highlights these amazing crossovers in American music between gospel and rhythm and blues, and in some ways rock and roll as well, and how a lot of performers that we recognize today as, you know, huge names got their start in the church choirs. So this is not an uncommon trajectory, at least back in the 50s and 60s.
For me, what's especially fascinating about this is it bucks that narrative trend that we see where we have an aspiring artist who's about to hit it big or has hit it big, and they surrender their family or the life that helped get them there in favor of fame, prestige, wealth, all that good stuff. So it's really admirable to see a man like to surrender all that to help his family.
I just love this idea that, you know, Bobby Iles probably grew up not having any idea about this, right? His memories of his granddad are of them going fishing together. And then as you grow up, you suddenly realize, and I think many of us have experiences like this, that people who we knew in one context as, you know, mom or dad or granddad or grandma or aunts or uncles, right, suddenly have this huge other career and are well known for whatever other reason. I just think it's really interesting to see how, you know, the way that we see our relatives doesn't always line up with the way the world sees them.
From Captain Q and Lieutenant Viernes and myself, thanks for joining us in these stories of our ancestors. We hope you will join us next time.
This has been a production of the History Department at the U.S. Naval Academy, located in Annapolis, Maryland. If you enjoy our programs, please let us know, as we'd love to hear your thoughts. You can reach us on Twitter and Instagram at USNA History, and our email is historyproductions-group@usna.edu. For more information about the History Department at the Naval Academy, please visit usna.edu/history.